Third hour of the program, live here from Bridgestone Arena, Jack Daniels Barrel House, Darren McFarland, and Willie Donick here with you. Titans set to do some interviews. Tonight it's the Predators and the Arizona Coyotes. Predators coming off a nice shutout victory over Vegas on Tuesday night. Unbelievable atmosphere here Tuesday night. Nobody was scared of the weather at all.
And they got free popcorn out of it, right?
Free popcorn and a soda.
Hey.
How about that?
Gotta love it.
Which is funny. I never called it soda. I used to call it pop.
Yeah.
But I called it a soda.
I remember the first time I was up in Ohio with my uncles and stuff, and they were all calling it pop. I was like, what are you guys talking about?
Yeah.
Soda.
So tonight it'll soda be pop. Arizona Coyotes. They played them 2 weeks ago out in the desert, and they fell in overtime. So 2 weeks ago today, so they get a little opportunity for a little revenge tonight. 7 o'clock puck drop. I'll have pregame for you at 6 right here on 102.5 The Game.
And I will tell you that the Coyotes are better than they were during that game. At least their personnel is better than it was that night. They've added since then Nick Jalmerson, very stabilizing force on defense, very good player. And they made the trade, even though Anthony Duclair had a really good game against the Predators that night. I think they feel good about Richard Panik back in the lineup for them, the guy that they got
from
Chicago.
Who had 20-something goals last year.
So they also had just gotten Jacob Chychrun back, who is one of their bright young defensemen who they're very high on. He's had a few games now to acclimate. So since that game, they haven't won a game, but they've taken – almost all of them to overtime. They've had three overtime losses since then. So they've been pesky. They've been hanging around. They've been more competitive. And that being said, you know, the Predators are without two 30-goal scorers from last year. So Arvidsson is out. Forsberg is out. It does look like Ryan Johansson has a good chance of being in there based on what we saw at practice yesterday.
Why do you think they made the trade?
Anthony Duclair, who was a – high-level prospect, high ceiling. He had fallen out of favor. I think he had gotten to the point where he had asked for a trade. And I think they tried to work through some stuff over about a year, year and a half. They changed coaches and had the same feeling about him. So they said, we're done. We don't think it's going to happen here. It was a little bit like a Dorial Green-Beckham situation here in Nashville. I think the new GM, the new coach said, he may do really well somewhere else, but it's not going to happen here. And I think Anthony Duclair was looking for a fresh start too. So it's a very interesting trade that has happened since that last meeting, especially because Duclair played well against the Predators. But he's in Chicago now. He's the kind of guy that could give them a lift. And meanwhile, Richard Panik's only 26. It's not like you got some middling guy. I didn't realize he was as young as he is. So he's a guy that, by the same token, had fallen out of favor in Chicago. He had, like you said, I think, 22 goals last year?
22 goals last year.
But he had not played
Remember, he had the
nearly
hat-trick.
As productively. He had a hat-trick against the Predators.
A ridiculous hat-trick,
yes.
A bogus hat-trick, but he had a hat-trick. Nonetheless,
no, Hartman had the one that was –
oh, that was Hartman?
Because
remember, they had two hat-tricks
against
them.
Yeah.
Last year with the Blackhawks, because they opened up the season with two games against Chicago, and it wasn't in back-to-back games,
yeah.
But I think Panik was the first one, right?
Panik added
the one
that
in
was
Chicago.
When Mazenitz played. Merrick Mazenitz played that game. And Panik had
and so hat-trick. Hartman's the one who had the bogus hat trick.
You know, is there such thing? I don't know. I would take it any way I could get it if I got
a
hat trick. But it was one went off his wrist, and one was an empty net, and one
was
kind
of
a
lame.
Yeah,
it was a lame hat trick. So my apologies to Richard Panik. I didn't want to lessen his hat trick. But it is an interesting trade, considering he had 22 goals and 22 assists last year with Chicago, and he's only 26. So obviously they feel like Anthony Duclair has much greater upside, or they wouldn't have made the trade.
He's got the higher ceiling. There's no doubt about it, but he has leveled off. He had a 20-goal season a couple years ago for Arizona at a young age, and he's still, what, only 22. But his production had fallen off. He had not progressed since that season.
So we'll see how that all shakes out. Predators get a nice homestand really this entire month. They have one road game left. So it's tonight against Arizona. Saturday it'll be against the Florida Panthers here. Next Tuesday against the Tampa Bay Lightning, and then an up and back to Newark.
I did
to take on the Devils next Thursday, and that is the lone road game left on the schedule this month.
I did a little blog for NashvillePredators.com, and I worked in our interview that we did earlier this week with David Poyle, sort of a second-half outlook. But I was looking through the schedule, Darren, and I had our people look, and according to Stats, Inc., you mentioned, first of all, it's a home-heavy schedule. Mm-hmm. They're in a stretch right now, 8 of 9 at home. Spread out, no back-to-backs this month with the bye week in there. And even after the first two games, which they've won, they've still got 21 home games and only 18 on the road between now and the end of the season. They also have, according to Stats, Inc., if you look at opponents' winning percentage in terms of strength of schedule, they have the 7th, and I hesitate to use this word, easiest schedule. Remember last year, it was not only clustered with a lot of back-to-backs. Remember, they had 26 games in the last 50 days last year, and they were playing beasts. They had to go to the West Coast. They had to play San Jose. They had to play at Washington, at Columbus, and they did really well in those games. This year, it's different. They've got 5 sets of back-to-backs left, and the winning percentage is the 7th easiest in terms of opponents. Now, it doesn't mean you show up and win. You've got to go win the games. But it sets up favorably for them to make a run at the division title, which is what they want. They've stated their goal. They want to win the division title. They want to get home ice advantage for the playoffs this year.
Well, I've already put it out there back in early December they were going to win the division. So they're going to win the division. That's going to happen.
They have 3 games left with Winnipeg, 2 of them in Winnipeg. That's one of the tougher teams left. That's the only team they play more than twice from here on out. They have 2 left with Arizona, home and home. They have 2 with Buffalo. They have 2 with Florida, including Saturday coming in here. And Florida's giving them trouble. Remember, Florida hasn't had a good year, but they beat them twice last year. They got talented players. I don't know what's going on. They're one of the schizo teams that you can't really tell what you get from night to night. They've got 2 with Ottawa, who's had a rough time. They have 2 with Detroit. They have a lot of games against Eastern teams. They have a trip to Montreal. Montreal has been struggling. Not that that's ever an easy place to win. They still have Edmonton and Vancouver in back-to-back road games. So it sets up favorably. That doesn't mean you're going to win, but I like how the schedule is shaping up. We'll see if they can take advantage of that. And, of course, injuries play a big part. They got to have a little luck. I mean, all of a sudden now you're playing without Forsberg and Arvidsson. For a minute there, you thought, wow, are they going to lose Ryan Johansson for a while there? Now, knock on wood, hopefully he's okay and he's in there tonight and there's no other issues from that. But you almost, within 24 hours, lost 2 of your top, all of a sudden your first line's gone.
Yep.
That can change your season in a hurry.
I had a good conversation with Ryan Ellis after skate this morning. You'll hear that in the pregame tonight. Just talking about him getting back. And I just asked him, I was like, was the bye week, you're in a little bit different set of circumstances. Everybody else was probably really happy to see the bye week. You had played 4 games on the season, and you had to go into a bye week. So was that a good thing for you? As Pete Weber, no, Pete, I'm not even halfway.
Yeah, Shakes McFarland. I mean,
it's
got a delivery this morning.
I'm working on it. But
from Pete Weber.
It's gonna take the whole show. Maybe and then some. I don't know. I'm not even sure I can finish it up by 2. I'm working. But I talked to him about, it's a unique set of circumstances because he played 4 games. And here he is, yeah. You have to sit out for a week. Now
he's probably looking for somebody to play with.
Right. I mean, he's trying to get back. And so we talked about that, just talked about how he feels, talked about just a different perspective of sitting there watching your team for the first half of the season. That's different, He's a guy that's logs all these minutes, has, played so many games and played so many minutes, and he's, the core of this team, right at the core of this team, and he had to sit there and watch. So we talked about that. So you'll hear that tonight in the pregame show in the 6 o'clock hour. Good conversation with Ryan Ellis, as always. Looks like we're having a little bit of trouble with Aaron Wilson from the Houston Chronicle. We're going to talk about Mike Vrabel, of course, who's going to be interviewing today for the head coaching job. So we may be doing some shuffling around. But I asked – we talked about this yesterday off the air, and I told Joe that we did and that I was going to ask it to you today. We were going to talk about it on the air, and I went on and asked him. I asked him to be Professor Rexrode and to give John Robinson a grade through his first 2 years. Everything that's happened, free agency, the draft, the firing of whatever's happened on his watch, it all counts.
Okay.
And if you remember, I gave you my grade off the air yesterday.
I thought you were just talking about the drafts at that point.
No, no, no. I was just talking
about the whole thing.
It's the whole
thing. Okay.
Whatever you want, whatever falls under his umbrella, it's fair game to discuss.
Okay.
On his watch.
For 2 years.
For 2 years. And so if you remember, I gave you my grade off the air, and your first reaction was, what?
Well, my first reaction was what, but I was only basing that on I thought you were talking about the two drafts that he's had.
Well, guess what Joe's grade
so now,
was?
So now my thought, if you put the whole thing in there, the job he's done, you still give the same grade?
Yes.
All right, so what was Joe's?
Exactly what I told you yesterday. B-minus.
B-minus.
Yep.
See, I think that's insane. What was their record in the two previous years before he became the general manager? 5-27.
A little to a lot.
5-27.
A little wins to a lot of losses.
5 wins, 27 losses. In 2 years, they have back-to-back winning seasons, and they've won a playoff game. I think based on that, if you look at how he's filled holes, if you look at how he's built a nucleus while not mortgaging the future with the salary cap, I don't see how you can go any lower than B plus. And I think you could even say, if you're looking at the whole thing, I would say A minus.
So according to your
assessment, the only downgrade for me why it would not be a straight up A is because they have benefited from an easy schedule. They've had a relatively easy schedule, and therefore opportunity to get better quicker.
It's not
because
relative
of the schedule.
It's a fact. They had the easiest schedule in the NFL this year. That's
yes.
a fact. That's not opinion.
No doubt.
That's a fact.
No doubt.
If you look at the who they played and their winning percentage this year, they had the easiest schedule in
yes.
the league.
But they were a hot mess when he took over. No?
We know
they
the answer
awful.
To that.
They were terrible.
Just listen to the show.
It
during
wasn't
that
just
time frame.
To me, it wasn't just 5-27. It was by the end of the year, there was almost no hope. You know, once they got a few guys hurt, they were done.
So by the turnaround, to me, it sounds like you're giving the coaches zero credit because you're saying that's all John Robinson. He deserves an A because they got better on his watch, so the coaches don't get to take in any of the credit.
Not necessarily. I think the coach deserves – the coaches
Well, if he's an
credit.
A, then what are they?
I think that the coaches would be a little less because of this year. I think there were opportunities missed to win another game or two. I said 10 before the season. And that was before Deshaun Watson was injured and Andrew Luck was injured. And we knew Andrew Luck wasn't going to play. So I thought 10 was reasonable, and there was a chance maybe for 11 if everything went right. But I do fall back on it's not an easy league to win in, especially when you haven't been winning and you don't have this deep barrel of talent. So I would say the coaching staff would get a B. I would go B-plus or A-minus for John Robinson. And now, as you said, this is probably the biggest theme of him deciding, you know, I guess collectively, that it's time for a change with the coaching staff. Now he believes he can get more from his coaching staff, and now there's more heat on him because this was his call. He could have probably played it safe and said, wait, 9-7, playoff win, coaching staff deserves to come back, and I don't think anybody would have said that's unfair.
Well, there would have been some because there were some that were just against.
Yeah,
Mike Mularkey and Terry Rubisky.
But if you're really being fair, you would have to say, "Hey,
you're right."
It's reasonable to bring the coaching staff back.
Whatever you thought about how it looked, right? Whatever you think, right? When it's all said and done, they went 10-8. I mean, they got to the divisional round of the playoffs.
Right.
They won a playoff game for the first time in 14 years.
If you're saying it's based on results, those are the results. So you can't. You couldn't say that's unreasonable. Now, when you look at it closer, as you said, and we discuss it throughout every day on the show, they didn't look very impressive in what they did.
To me, he has sped up his clock because I think it would have been the safer play would have been to come out and say, you know what? divisional round of the playoffs, first playoff win in 14 seasons. You don't have to give an extension, but they're all going to their final year. We'll see how it all plays out.
Now, where did you say they're picking in the first round?
I think 25th.
So this is where it starts to get harder. It's as we said, it's a lot easier to go from awful to mediocre than mediocre to good. And now you're trying to go from good to championship contender. This is really where it gets hard because you don't get to pick high anymore. Your first pick is pick 25. You only have one first-round pick. You don't have two. So it's going to be harder to get immediate help from the draft, you would think. But what I like is he set himself up. There's not as many glaring holes as when he took over. He's done a good job in that area. And he's done it while still having money to work with to address things with the salary cap. So the right free agent here and there, he's shown, I think, a pretty good ability to not overpay for a free agent, but bring in guys who have plugged a hole. If nothing else, Jonathan Cyprian plugged a hole, right? He was an upgrade. He wasn't great,
but
he was okay.
Once again,
plugged a hole.
And he didn't
break the bank.
It had nowhere to go but up.
Yes, but
that position was really weak.
The secondary was in shambles. And Logan Ryan, Jonathan Cyprian, drafted a couple guys in the mid to lower rounds that have helped.
Well, Kevin Byard was third round.
Kevin Byard has helped a lot. He's the biggest showcase guy. I mean, they've hit on a Pro Bowler through the draft.
But he didn't have to deal with any salary cap restrictions.
Even Kalen Reed.
They had loads of money to spend.
Yes, and he hasn't blown all that money.
Sure.
He's made budget-smart pickups in that area. Usually, cornerbacks cost you a lot, right? Logan Ryan was expensive relatively, but that's what you have to pay for to buy a starting corner.
We asked people on Twitter. I'm just kind of sifting through. There was a lot of responses. Ron.
Grades?
Yeah, grades. Ron said B+.
There you go.
Chris said B+. Matthew said B-. Someone said a flat B. Brett said a C. Troy, a B. Trevor, C+. Jarrett, a B. Toby, A-. B+ from Josh. A from Ryan. C+ from Mike. There was a D-. Somebody
a
did
D
give him
minus?
A D-.
John Robinson. Now,
yeah, that's,
so
that's,
5 and 27.
I thought that was like,
two
okay.
Back-to-back 9 and 7s get you a D-. I'm glad I don't have him as a professor.
Yeah, no kidding. Mark, a B. Yeah, that would be hard to justify. A D-, great. I don't know where that came. But that's just kind of quickly sifted through. We got a ton of responses from folks. Zach just came in, B+. So I think most people are in the B+, B-
range. Why did Joe give him a B- in his mind? What was his that the schedule was easy and they should have won?
No. I mean, look, right now Kevin Dodd is a dud. Kevin Dodd,
okay,
that's
but you're picking out the
him.
One guy that hasn't that's been a dud. They've been for Kevin Dodd, I can list
Willie,
you three or four guys that have been good.
He was the first pick in the second round.
I know.
A first pick in the second round has to work.
No, it doesn't.
That's basically a first-round pick.
But it doesn't always work out.
There's incompletes right now. Incompletes. Like Corey Davis is an incomplete. It's the fifth pick in the draft, and he basically gave you nothing this year. The fifth pick in the draft. Adoree Jackson, good, not great. Could be great. Not yet.
He's good.
Whether you want to buy into this or not, the backup quarterback situation was a failure. That's an F. That was a failed. You went into the season. That was failed.
But what you don't know.
That is a mark against you.
But what you don't know is what was the value behind the scenes of Matt Cassel over the 2 years? What positive influence did he have on Marcus Mariota?
They don't have the luxury
quantify.
With the style of Marcus Mariota to have a mentor as the backup quarterback. The backup quarterback has to be able to play because you have a quarterback that hasn't proven he stands upright for 16
games.
Well,
I think now – but now that your quarterback is going into his fourth year, I don't think the mentor part of it is necessary anymore. I think Matt Cassel has served his purpose.
Shouldn't have been there for the third year.
So it's not an F. It's definitely it burned them this year in a one game in the one game that almost cost them a chance to go to the playoffs. I mean, that game could have really cost them because they should have won that game, and Matt Cassel was not serviceable.
Right, and they had to play Mariota the rest of the
right,
way, no matter what.
They were not going to try
unless he was taken out on the Gator. Mariota had to play the rest of the year.
He did,
right? I mean, there was not an option.
Fortunately, he did. It didn't burn him that bad, which is why you probably avoid getting an F on
that.
But it's a C at best.
No, it's not a C. It's worse than a C.
And now I think it's pretty obvious. You got to go out and you probably have to spend some money on a backup.
Yep.
And well, hopefully you don't have to spend that much money, but it's time for a new guy.
We flopped, so we'll go to Houston to kick off the fourth hour. We're going to go up to Minneapolis. AJ Mansour, K-Fan up there. We'll talk about the Vikings, what's going on with them, NFC Championship game.
Are we going to sing the Vikings
Skull.
Fight song?
Skull
Vikings?
Well, we can do that. That's fun. That was pretty cool.
Let's just
we
cue
talk
up
AJ
the Vikings fight
that.
Song. Vikings fight, Skull Vikings.
So we'll go down to Houston at 1 o'clock. We'll be back with more here on 102.5 The Game.
Skull Vikings, let's win this game. Skull Vikings, honor your name. Go get that first down, then get a touchdown. Rock 'em, sock 'em, fight, 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 fight. Skull Vikings, run up the score. You'll hear us.
We like to make our guests feel comfortable. I think there's no better way to do that than to have that coming out of the break. Darren McFarland, Willie Tonic here at Bridgestone Arena. Yeah, there we go. Let's head up to Minneapolis.
I'll tell you what else we need to do before the show is over, or maybe at the end of the segment here. Paul Allen's call. We've had Paul on their play-by-play guy before. He is emotional. Mm-hmm. His call of the last play, it's just total chaos. You know, the crowd's going crazy. Yeah. Nobody can believe it. I mean, it's a great call. We need to play that later. So maybe Paul Allen's call of the digs catch.
Well, you understand that being in the booth when you don't expect
something
to happen and then you've got to break out into a very, very unexpected call, and that's what you'll get. Yeah, we'll play that a little bit later. AJ Mansour, K-Fan up in Minneapolis, joins us. AJ, how you doing?
Hey, I'm doing good, and let me tell you what, if you think that the call was good, there's a video of that as well that surfaced shortly after the game. We have it up on our website, kfan.com. Seeing his reaction, and you can look through his booth into the booth behind him is the Vikings coach's booth, and watching him lose his mind, watching the coaches lose their mind, understandably, is kind of a cool scene as well. But I'm doing really well. Thank you guys for having me. Exciting times up here in Minnesota, like you guys were saying.
Yeah, we obviously had our miracle. I noticed we've had a spawn of the Music City Miracle. I heard a lot of people calling it the Minneapolis Miracle. We had our version 20 years ago, so we remember it well, and we were in attendance. What was it like? Because I think the same thing. It was just, in fact, I was doing at the time a live call-in to then Sporting News Radio to basically report that the Bills had come in and done what no team had done in their brand new home, and that's hand the Titans a loss. They hadn't lost at home to that point after the field goal, and literally the play happened as I was on, and I broke out into a legal play-by-play on nationally syndicated radio. But it was just – it was hard. It took a while just for it to sink in, like, oh, my gosh, that just happened. What was it like up there?
Well, it was the same way. I mean, we were in the press box, and, you know, press box is supposed to – you're supposed to behave yourself and sit in your seat, and there's no cheering, and all those rules got thrown out the window when something like that happened. You know, there's a history up here in Minnesota, especially with the Minnesota Vikings, that – things like this can happen to us, but we're usually on the receiving end, the other end, where the Saints kick a field goal. Brett Favre throws an interception right at the end of the game. Blair Walsh misses a field goal. Gary Anderson in 1998 misses a field goal, the only one he missed all season long, and he misses one in the NFC Championship game. The Vikings are usually on the other end of this. So there was just this feeling that Drew Brees and the Saints had come into our home, and it's all happening again. We were up 17-0 at the half, and they gave that lead away. We regained it temporarily at the end of the game, and then the Saints went down, and Will Lutz kicked a field goal to give them a one-point lead. Everybody was down, and in the matter of 10 seconds, a miracle happened, like you said, and it the place went nuts. There's another video that I'm sure, you know, everyone's seen all these videos that are being shared. It's a sideline cam from the Minnesota Vikings Entertainment Network, that there's no play-by-play. All it is the audio inside the stadium, and you hear when Stephon Diggs catches that football, which effectively put them in field goal range, where if he would have gone out of bounds, if he would have been, you know, forced out of bounds, whatever, they could have kicked a field goal 50 yards or so to win that game. Everybody went bonkers. And then when they realized that there was nobody there to tackle him and he was breaking for the end zone, the loudest noise I've ever heard in my life got even louder, and the place just, it was pandemonium. Nobody knew what to do. The players were at a loss for words. The fans were falling over in the stands. Paul Allen was and this is not a joke, was literally pushing fans out of his press box. They were trying to climb up in and celebrate with the Vox to celebrate the victory because everyone was just going bonkers. So it was crazy.
We're going to hit you with a bunch of stuff. So we'll come back, I'm sure. But I do want to hit you with this, AJ, because we're trying to get a feel as the Titans made it. Obviously, it changed the course of our show on Monday morning when the announcement came out about 45 minutes to an hour before our show, and we went wall-to-wall for 4 hours about the Titans parting ways with Mike Mularkey. And so now the interviewing process is going on, and everybody's trying to figure out, you know, where this is headed, what the feel is going to be. And I've kind of cautioned everybody. I think we get caught up in this, you know, one example, Sean McVay, and now everybody needs to hire a 31-year-old head coach, which I think is absolutely ludicrous. As I pointed out all week, Mike Zimmer, he's not exactly a spring chicken. I believe he's in his 60s. Doug Marrone is not some young, up-and-coming coach. Bill Belichick, nothing needed to be said there. What was the feeling in Minneapolis when they hired Mike Zimmer? What were you guys talking about? Today it's easy. I know what the storyline is today. But back when they hired him in 2014, what were you guys discussing?
Well, I think people were excited for the hire. It's kind of the way that coaching in football goes. You have a hard-nosed, yell at the players kind of a coach. That doesn't work out, and the next coach is a quiet, serene guy who's going to be the player's friends, but he earns their respect along the way. That was Leslie Frazier, and then when he got fired, Mike Zimmer came in, and we Googled him real quick to learn as much as we can, and you pull up videos from the Cincinnati Bengals and Hard Knocks, and you see Zimmer cussing out his players in the huddle, and that was the hard-nosed guy. So I think people thought that it was going to come in, and he was going to change the locker room. What I don't think people thought or knew about him at the time is that in changing that locker room, it wasn't a disciplinarian kind of a approach. It was more of a respect approach that he got from the players here in Minnesota, where they bought in 100% that first season. They bought into what he was selling, and it wasn't because he was the coach. It was because they believed in it. They believed in who he was. He invested in them on a personal level, but also on a coaching level on the football field. And in that very first year, you bring in a couple different players, X-Factors like Anthony Barr. You sign Everson Griffin to a new deal. That's now the cornerstones of this defense that he's established here. Now you have a couple more drafts under your belt, some free agent classes to bring people in. And you're reaping the benefits of his defensive mastermind that we saw a little bit of in Cincinnati. We saw flashes of last year before the Vikings wet the bed after the bye week and missed the playoffs after starting 5-0. But this year, it's all paying off, and there's no problems in the locker room. Obviously, when you're in the NFC Championship, everybody's happy. But at the same time, I think people see a legacy coach in Mike Zimmer now. And you mentioned he's an older guy. He learned a lot along the way, had some interviews along the way, and maybe because of his personality, wasn't getting those jobs. He was kind of a rash personality and might not have been getting those jobs, but it was the right fit here in Minnesota. And obviously, people, the fans, the people in the organization, and the players all love him.
AJ Mansour on the line with us, KFAN in Minneapolis. So we also have Tim Hasselbeck, who lives here in Nashville, join us every Wednesday for a couple of segments. And yesterday on the show, talking about some of these candidates, it was interesting. He brought up a name that nobody else has brought up to us that said, because offense is going to be key. It's kind of what got Mike Mularkey in trouble and his staff and, the growth or lack of with Marcus Mariota. Tim was pretty adamant about bringing in a guy like a Brad Childress, who's out there doing
as an offensive,
just
guru,
as a like
not
a,
not the head coach, right, but a guy you could bring in,
a consultant, kind of like Tom Moore did that here with Mike Munchak and his staff. Like kind of a consultant, a guy behind the scenes, a guru that can help everybody out. A guy who's been in the league for a long time. He was pretty adamant about Brad Childress. Obviously, he was the coach there. I don't know how much you were around Brad Childress. What do you think when you hear that?
Well, here's what I think of when I think Brad Childress. I'm a firm believer that you certainly can teach an old dog new tricks. What got Brad in trouble here in Minnesota when he was the head coach and had a firm hand in the offensive game plan, being a mastermind with that Philadelphia offense, he came here with that rapport. What he didn't do, or what he did do, he tried to make his offense work with the players here. He didn't necessarily adapt his offense to the players that he had on the roster. And I think that's where he got in trouble. When he came here, Tavares Jackson was the quarterback for this team. So you're limited at maybe your most important position. And he didn't change anything. He still ran the offense as if Donovan McNabb was running it, and it just wasn't working. So hopefully he has learned from that, and if he does get another opportunity, he is adopting the mindset that you need to adapt your offense to the players that you have. And that really is what the difference here in Minnesota was between Norv Turner last year when he walked away from this team and when Pat Shurmur ended up taking over last year and then this year had a phenomenal year and will probably end up getting a head coaching job. Pat came in and he adapted the offense to the players on the field. Sam Bradford last year, Case Keenum this year, dealing with injuries, dealing with adaptation through the season. They lost Adrian Peterson last year. They lost Dalvin Cook this year. So 2 years in a row, you lose your starting quarterback and your starting running back in the same season, and you still find success. That's part of his success there. And that, I think, is part of the detriment with Childress. So if he can get over that and he can really adapt to the players that are on that roster, because I think there is some talent there. Obviously, there's some talent there. I think that he can have an impact in a positive direction, but he just needs to stop being so stubborn and learn the new way of the NFL.
AJ, it is interesting to hear you talk about how the storyline changed. I'm sure you spent the entire preseason talking about Sam Bradford and Dalvin Cook, because I know we were here when we were talking about the Vikings, and then suddenly you have Case Keenum, and you have the other running backs who have done a fantastic job in Murray and McKinnon there. But in your mind, when you watched it all come down, how did they do it? How were they able to adjust when you have major injury issues like that?
Well, I think it starts with the personnel depth that they developed through the offseason. When it first started we went to free agency first, and they went out and got Latavius Murray as a running back, thought he was going to be the starter, and then shortly thereafter, Dalvin Cook is drafted. And everyone's kind of like, what's going on here? We just brought in a new running back. We did this, we did that. Dalvin ends up being the starter, phenomenal talent. Week four, tears his ACL, and he's out. McKinnon was still on the roster, and Murray was still getting over an injury, so there was a little adjustment period there. But having depth there, bringing in Case Keenum, last year it was Sean Hill. If Sean Hill would not have been able to step in for Sam Bradford this year and fill in the way that Case Keenum has, there would have been a severe drop-off. So it starts with the general manager bringing in the right personnel that, again, fit into what is happening here, because for backups, you need to fit them into what's going on more so. And then with the starter then, you have Sam Bradford in the picture from last year, and Sam had a great game. That first game, week one against New Orleans, was the best game of his career. And everyone thought that everything was going to be great with Sam Bradford. You need to get him an extension and keep him here in Minnesota long-term. And little did we know behind the scenes, his knee was falling apart. And he didn't come back until this last week where he served as a backup for the first time. So you have that there. But I just think that, they were able to adapt the offense so that Case Keenum didn't have to come in and do exactly what Sam did in that first weekend. He was able to grow into it. And in that, the players learn what Keenum does differently. Keenum learns what the wide receivers do differently. And one of the things that Keenum does so well is let's call it a slight scramble. It's not like he's going to run the football like Cam Newton kind of a thing, but it's more like Ben Roethlisberger, small area quickness where you can get avoid the first pressure tackle sack in the backfield and extend a play and open it up for a guy like Adam Thielen to break off a route and come back to you to get a big gain. That's where they found their success, and that's one of the things that Keenum has brought to the table that Bradford just didn't have.
Where did they find Thielen? The more you hear about it, I hear it's a very interesting story. I've only heard the story quickly between plays, that sort of thing. But you probably could give us a little bit more detail on him, because what a heck of a player and what a find.
Yeah, I mean, diamond in the rough. And fortunately for the Vikings, it was right here in their own backyard. Adam Thielen is from northern Minnesota, Detroit Lakes. He played Division II football. It was the only offer he got at Minnesota State, Mankato, South Minnesota, and was not drafted. He was brought into the rookie mini camp, which is the first weekend of off-season programming, where they simply need to bring in some local football players so they have enough people to run the drills with the new rookies that just got drafted. So he comes into rookie mini camp. This is probably his last shot at football. And he impresses enough to have them sign him to the practice squad, where he was firmly supplanted for a couple years, ends up making the 53-man roster, where he was inactive for a while. And then last year he really splashed. You know, it's just a true testament to a guy who works hard at his craft. He's fast. He's physically talented, but for whatever reason, he was overlooked. He dominated Division II. They won some national championships with Minnesota State. But at the same time, he got overlooked, and he took to training. He's a precision route runner, and that's really one of his skills. On top of being physically talented, he will be precise, and he'll run the right routes and set up that DB to a point where he's the only one that can burn them and take them there and set them up and then make that double move and go. And it really is, obviously, he developed into one of the top five wide receivers in the league this year. Nobody can say that they saw that coming. But it's a testament to his hard work, to the research of this team, to just pay attention to the guys in the local community. You know, Minnesota is not necessarily known as a football hotbed, but they had their pulse on the local teams, the local colleges here. And he splashed on their radar enough to get noticed and made the best of it once he got to the NFL.
We had a theme bringing you into the show. We'll have a theme wrapping this up. Let's go on and hear the call.
Big mistake. You just got to be able to – you got to take advantage of it when they do that kind of stuff.
10 seconds to go. 24-23 Saints. Vikings at their own 39. It's third down. Three receivers right, Thielen left. Marshawn Lattimore, 12 yards from Adam. Case on a deep drop, steps up in the pocket. He'll fire to the right side, caught by Diggs.
Stay up!
Oh, my God, loose!
Oh, my God!
30!
No!
10! Touchdown!
Are you kidding me?
Miracle finish!
It's a Minneapolis miracle! Stephon Diggs and the Minnesota Vikings have walked off on the New Orleans Saints. It's a 61-yard Minneapolis miracle! I can't believe what I just saw, Paul. What an unbelievable play! Fans at U.S. Bank Stadium are embracing each other. They're trying to climb into the box to hug us all. Nobody can find Stephon Diggs. He ran into the tunnel. Unbelievable, Paul.
They went from 0 to 10 in a hurry.
Yeah, it was like this.
It was
so
very
quiet.
Calm and
it's
somber.
Third down. It's the 39-yard line.
Feeling to the right.
That was great.
Probably never gets old hearing that, AJ.
It doesn't. We discovered the Portuguese play-by-play this morning, and it's just as good. You know, you're finding every angle. We're going to live this as long as we can.
Hey, thanks for doing this. Really appreciate it.
Sounds good, guys. Appreciate the time.
AJ Mansour, K-Fan up in Minneapolis. Appreciate him joining us. Back to wrap up the third hour next. So we are going to head to Houston to kick off the fourth hour and find out a little bit more about Mike Vrabel. And I just wanted to get a little perspective on Mike Zimmer because he is 61 years old. And I just think, and I said this earlier, Willie, you were downstairs in some meetings, so you didn't hear this part. But to me, Sean McVay is the brand new restaurant in your town, right? Everybody's going to give it a try. Like, I don't judge anything by a new restaurant and their success in the first 6 months. Because everybody's going to go give it a try. I mean, it's just a natural instinct. Oh, something new in our town? Other people have checked it out? I got to go check out this new place. It's a new thing.
It's a new thing,
and it
but
works.
It's the first time through, the buzz and the feedback
the
is
the first
good.
Time through. But come back in a year and tell me where the restaurant is. Is it still the same? Still have the same buzz?
But
or things tailed off.
Sometimes you go into the first time and you're like, oh, that wasn't very good.
Yeah. And I don't think that's going to be the experience in this case. So far, the experience has been very good. But you don't judge a restaurant on the first 6 months, right? Tell me a year later, how are they doing? Are the numbers the same? Are they just as high? Did it grow? Or has it started to decline? Because it's all about sustaining success, right? Getting quick success really means nothing. Everybody's going to try a new product. Anything new, they're going to try it out. But then, once they've tried it out, then they make up their mind, do I like it, do I not like it? Even if they maybe are still in that weird period early on, it's about sustaining. It's always about, okay, tell me a year from now what it looks like. Next year, if they go 7-9, and I'm not saying that I'm a disbeliever in Sean McVay. I'm just saying let's all slow down on the, oh, my gosh. You got to get the young whippersnapper, the up-and-coming. And the only example you got is Sean McVay, because for every Sean McVay, there are tons of failures. Tons. Okay? And right now, when you look around, three of the four coaches are not some young up-and-coming whippersnappers. Doug Marrone, Bill Belichick, and Mike Zimmer are three of the four coaches standing, and they're not 31 years of age. This just in. And it may look better next year. It may not. You know, everybody is going to study Sean McVay and the Rams in the offseason. These guys are pretty good in the NFL. They'll figure out your weaknesses. And next year, if they go 7-9, you know what nobody will be talking about? Sean McVay.
I think the number one thing that has had me thinking this week is something that Tim Hasselbeck said yesterday, and that is, even if your goal is to fix the offense, your number one priority anyway is to fix the offense, I think it's a very sound decision sometimes to hire a defensive coach who turns the offensive over, the offense over to a guru who can really focus on it. So the offensive coordinator is just as important to hire in a lot of ways as the head coach. And of course, the head coach is most important because he's your leader. But it's a separate thing. Whether the head coach is the guy that is the mastermind of the offense, it doesn't necessarily matter. You don't have to bring in an offensive mind to be your head coach. I think Sean McVay is probably a good head coach, in addition to being able to overhaul the offense the way he did. But I've seen it happen where, like Mike Zimmer is a good example, right? He turns the offense over to somebody, and he got the most out of what they had to work with. And that was a difficult set of circumstances. You lose your starting quarterback and your starting running back, and you still have enough to get to the championship game.
Think about it. Dalvin Cook looked very early on in the season like, wow, they have hit on something. A second-round pick from Florida State? Like, they have really nailed it with Dalvin Cook. Well, they lose him for the year. They lose their Hall of Fame running back in the offseason in Adrian Peterson. And here they still sit. And, oh, by the way, they're on their third-string quarterback, who they've had most the entire season. Is Keenum been basically the entire season?
Basically, yeah. I do think
– And here they sit.
Did Bradford even start the season? I don't know that he did.
I'm trying to remember when he got hurt. I mean, there's been so many Bradford injuries.
You can write a book.
Sorry, but I get lost in all the Sam Bradford injuries. And Teddy Bridgewater, I mean, there really hasn't been any – that's how good Case Keenum has been. He has fit into – to me, it's really – it's what I've been saying. I think they need to start looking. John Robinson needs to look more at building up this defense because it's time to stop relying so much on your quarterback. Until you're one of the few teams that has that generational-type quarterback, which – Marcus Mariota may be really, really good. He's not going to be Aaron Rodgers or Tom Brady or Drew Brees. You have to build it a little bit differently. It doesn't mean you can't win with him, but you have to help him. And I don't believe throwing offensive players at him all the time is necessarily helping him, because Jacksonville and Minnesota have proven that. And quite honestly, right now, Philadelphia has proven it, because Nick Foles can't throw the ball more than 10 yards down the field, and they're still finding themselves in the NFC Championship game. I mean, I realize it. Nick Foles won, and they beat the Falcons. But did you watch him? Nick Foles can't throw. And yet they're sitting here in the championship game. Because why? Because they can play defense. They held Atlanta to 10 points. It can run the ball. It's built just like Jacksonville and Minnesota. They're not – it's not about the quarterback going out there and winning them the game.
Keenum played 15 games. I'm trying to look. I'm not seeing how many of those he started. I guess they had the Monday night game early in the season when they whipped New Orleans. I guess Bradford played that
Remember
game.
Remember he played a half? Remember he looked awful? And it was like, why is he out there? Remember that game early on in the season? You're like – or maybe it was when he came back. Didn't he come? He came back on a Monday night game or a Sunday night game or something. I remember it was a nationally televised game, and you're watching him and you're going, why is Sam Bradford out there? He can't move. And sure enough, he didn't come out and play the second half. And I think that was it. I don't think we saw him the rest of the year. You remember that game?
I do not. Not specifically, but – I remember the opening game where they looked really good against the Saints. It just destroyed them.
Yep.
I'll have it here in a minute.
That was the Adrian Peterson stare. We'll come back and kick off the fourth hour, and we'll head down to Houston. We'll talk to Aaron Wilson from the Houston Chronicle.
14 starts for Keenum.
There you go. We'll do that next on 102.5 The Game.